Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Sharon Rotbard, senior lecturer at Bezalel Academy in Jerusalem. He's here to talk to us about his new book, White City, Black City, Architecture and War in Tel Aviv and Jaffa, published in 2015 by Pluto Press and MIT. Sharon, thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Thank you. Hello.
First off, could you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book?
I was the White City narrative started to be very present in public life, more or less in the beginning of my adulthood. At the time in the 80s, when it first came up as a quite a modest exhibition at the Tel Aviv Museum for Art, I was quite taken by this story, and it coincided with my own architecture studies in Paris a few years later. When I came back from Paris about eight years after I left Israel, I landed into a huge festival of Bauhaus and White City celebrations in Tel Aviv. It was more or less at the time of the peace process with the Palestinians, and there were many architects and scholars coming from all over the world. And at more or less at that time, it started to annoy me. I started to take note of all kinds of small inaccuracies in the story, and I was not very happy with the way the whole narrative was appropriated by the establishment. I could not see how it is used for different political purposes. More or less at the same time, I decided to, to settle in the south, in the south of Tel Aviv, in Shapira neighborhood, a very old neighborhood which once was part of Jaffa. And I, when I was interested in the history of my own neighborhood, I suddenly discovered that there's nothing written about it. So it started with a big gap between the historization of a few parts of the city. So, in fact, from that moment on, I started to research and to try to look for information about my own neighborhood history, but also about Jaffa. And at a certain moment, I got into a very clear insight that there is a kind of correlation between the city's history and the city geography. I could not ignore the fact that, for example, my own neighborhood, which at the time was considered as one of the poorest neighborhoods neighborhoods in Tel Aviv. There is a certain relationship between the fact that in the most canonical history book of Tel Aviv, the whole neighborhood gets something like 4 or 5 lines, and the fact that the municipality does not clear the garbage every day like it does in other neighborhoods in Tel Aviv. So, in fact, that encouraged me to start searching for other kind of resources, but also to be much more critical vis-a-vis the White City narrative, and to try to understand how this story was told, what was its role within the Tel Aviv and Israeli cultural life, and of course to sketch some kind of a new history for the other parts of the city, alias the Black City or Jaffa.
Great. All right, so let's start with Tel Aviv and how it came to be called the White City. Where did this idea of the White City come from? And you mentioned that there were sort of inaccuracies in how the sort of myth of the White City came about. What were the sort of inaccuracies in the sort of the standard history that's given? And also, if you could dig into, you mentioned already, sort of the ideological purpose that the White City myth serves.
There were a few steps in the construction of this narrative. First of all, this image of the White City was something that was already mentioned in very early writings about Tel Aviv. But in fact, it became an important issue with an exhibition created by Michael Levin, an art historian who specializes in architecture. So in fact, in 1984, Michael Levin curated this exhibition at the Tel Aviv Museum of Art titled White City. This exhibition displayed various buildings in Israel, in Tel Aviv, but also in a few other cities in Israel, such as Haifa or Jerusalem. At the time, it was quite a modest and small show, but it had a huge effect on the revival of the city center of Tel Aviv. So already in the 80s. The municipality of Tel Aviv decided to revive the city center of Tel Aviv, the district which nowadays is called the White City. But in fact, it took about 10 years until it became an almost official policy or an official narrative of the city of Tel Aviv. It is also important to note that already from the beginning of the 60s or the late 50s, there was a very famous song called White City, which was sung by Arik Einstein, one of the most loved pop stars in Israel. So in a sense, this the title of the exhibition and the title of this part of the city somehow merged with those images of White City as we as they echoed in Israel in various sections of Israeli culture. Now, in fact, there were a few brand names that were associated with the with this narrative of Tel Aviv. First is, of course, this idea of a white city, and secondly, its association with different parts of modernist movement in architecture. Strangely, from all the influences that one could identify in Tel Aviv's architecture, the most common name that somehow was suggested was this idea of Bauhaus. So if we try to tell this narrative like in two lines, one could tell this story as such, as follows. During the beginning of the 20th century, there was this very advanced and progressive school in Germany called the Bauhaus. In the beginning of the 30s, Hitler came to power. He shut down the school. All the teachers and the students spread all over the world. The Jews among them immigrated to Israel, to Tel Aviv, and built the White City. So in a sense, the narrative behind this story, and it was, I'm not inventing it, it was written in one of the most central books about this architecture by the artist Danny Caravan. Tel Aviv and its modernist architecture is some kind of a victory or revenge over the Nazis. It says that like you didn't want the modernist and Jews, modernist architecture and Jews in Germany. So here now, please accept us here in Israel. There were also some other parts of this story which suggested that, in fact, Tel Aviv was built upon dunes or upon the sands. And in fact, there was really nothing there before the city was built. So in fact, it enabled us to tell the story of Tel Aviv without getting into all kinds of problematic issues concerning the very same period in the history. So at this moment, when we started telling the architectural history of Tel Aviv, we also disconnected it from the general history of Israel. And while, for example, in the 30s, it was a very dramatic period in which we had more than 3 years of some kind of intifada, what was titled by the British as the Great Arab Revolt. It was also a great time of settlements. There were many, some dozens of new settlements erected all over the country. Suddenly, we have a piece of Israeli history which has nothing to do whatsoever with the political situation in the Middle East. It has nothing to do with Tel Aviv's most close neighbor, the historical city of Jaffa. So let's say that in the overall, this was the main flaw that encouraged me to start researching. Later on, when I started to get into a more close look at this narrative, so even if we start checking what was the exact influence of the Bauhaus school on Tel Aviv, we might discover that, in fact, from all the Bauhaus graduate or students who immigrated to Palestine at the time, there were only four or five architects who were more or less active. Most of them were active in other districts of the country, in Haifa or in the kibbutzim. There was one graduate who worked in the Tel Aviv municipality and was in fact just a clerk. The most famous architect that was trained in the Bauhaus, Arye Sharon, he was much more involved in big projects in other areas of Israel or Palestine in the kibbutzim. And in fact, much later, in the beginning of the 80s, when people start to get interested with this narrative, he was the one to say that, in fact, there's no influence of Bauhaus on the Tel Aviv architecture. You might mention some other influences, such as Le Corbusier or French modern architects. But that, in fact, the whole use of Bauhaus is completely is a complete mistake. I would say that this tendency to shift this narrative towards this Central European source of modern architecture. I would guess that it stemmed either from this idea that Tel Aviv in some respects might be considered as a victory of the Jewish people over the Nazis. But of course it had some other agendas which matched a certain hierarchy within the Jewish Ashkenazi communities that were residing in Israel, in which there is a certain hierarchy between the Mitteleuropa and the East and the Ostjuden, people who came from Berlin or from Vienna were considered to be much more cultivated or advanced than normally Jews who came from Poland or Ukraine. Nevertheless, I would say that you can't really say that most of the architects in Tel Aviv studied in Bauhaus, neither to say none of Bauhaus teachers, people like Gropius or Miss van der Rohe, never set their foot on the soil of the Holy Land. And of course, there were many architects who were trained in Eastern Europe, in Belgium, in France, in Italy, or even in Palestine, in the Technion, which was already active at the time. So to sum it up, I would say that it became quite a curious phenomenon that if you go to a library and you look at the bookshelves of books about Tel Aviv, about 80% of those books would somehow be associated with this narrative of the White City or modern architecture or Bauhaus architecture. And of course, those narratives are applied only to one very specific area in the city of Tel Aviv. From the other hand, you could notice that some other neighborhoods, such as Neve Sha'anan or Florentine or Shapira, who were founded about a decade before the White City, they were lacking any record or any publications or research about it. So there was this. This is the main flaw, I think, of this narrative. And of course, if you get into more into details, you can see that this idea of a new white city, which is erected on the empty dunes, is completely ironical, and that in fact this was more kind of a wishful thinking that you could also find it in visual in the iconography of Tel Aviv as it was as it has been established from the 30s. So if you see, in my book, there is a very striking example how, in fact, a whole neighborhood such as Manshia, quite a big neighborhood, that in fact separated between Tel Aviv and its beach, was in fact transformed already in drawings made in the 30s, which was transformed into some kind of a dune. So in a sense, it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy or wishful thinking that later on was realized after the conquest of Jaffa and its annexation to Tel Aviv.
Okay, yeah, let's move on and talk about part two of your book, where you talk about what you call the Black City. Tell us about the history of Jaffa and the other side of this mythological story of Tel Aviv.
Of course, there are many ways to start this narrative of Jaffa. In my book, I do not really pretend to write a new history of Jaffa, because that will require getting into Ottoman documents and Arabic documents. In fact, most of the records of Jaffa were destroyed during the 48 war. So, in fact, there had been once upon a time there was this city called Jaffa, which in fact existed until 1948. Jaffa and its hinterland. In Jaffa and its hinterland was a population of some 100,000 inhabitants, or even a little bit more. And in fact, from all those, this population, by the end of in the moment when Jaffa surrendered on the 13th of May 1948. From all this population, there were only about 3,000 or 4,000 people remaining. All of them were moved out, evicted, ran away to other regions of the country, or even to other countries in the region. So, in a sense, Jaffa was conquered in, as I said, in May 1948, after a few months of hostilities that some of them were perpetrated by far-right organizations that were active at the time within the Jewish community in Palestine, such as the Etzel, or the Lehi, the Stern Gang, as it was coined by the British, or the organization headed by Menachem Begin at the time. By the end of the hostilities, the city suffered a huge physical damages. It became almost empty from its population, and soon later, as it happened with all the Palestinian properties in Israel Palestine, it was in fact annexed to Tel Aviv. But also, what is more important, the lands and real estate was confiscated by the state of Israel. By the law of the properties of absentees, which in fact made us, in fact, until this very day, it is about 90% of the all the real estate properties in Israel. In fact, they got to the state's hand following this law and the war of 48. But if we speak of the history of the city as something which might generate a certain process of renewal, of course, Jaffa is a very, very ancient city. You can find records of it in the Greek mythologies, in the Greek mythology, or in the Jewish scriptures. So it's a city old of a few thousands of years, three or even 4,000 years of of history and record. Nevertheless, when the narrative of Jaffa is told by the official arms of the city or of the state, normally there are all kinds of highlights which are kind of more celebrated or emphasized in this narrative. First, the passage of Napoleon Bonaparte in Jaffa in 1799 during the Egyptian campaign, and also all the beginnings of the Jewish modern presence, and later on the Zionist influence on Jaffa, because Jaffa, for at least during the 19th century, was considered by the Jews as the gate of Zion. This was the place where Jews would come, first arrive to Palestine. So in a sense, at least for a certain time, it was an important point in which people would come. They would be treated or welcomed by the Jewish or Zionist institutions. So of course, in most of the Israeli narratives of Jaffa, there's no much information about how Jaffa actually was. It is important to know that Jaffa, until 48, was the most important center, cultural and economical center of Palestinian presence in Palestine. It was a very important place, also due to the reputation of the citrus culture in the region. The Jaffa oranges, of course, is a very well-known brand name, and has been so for all over the 20th century. And what is also quite interesting to know is that at least from all over the 19th century until, let's say, the beginning of the 20s in the 20th century, Jaffa was also a place where very different community coexisted in a relatively peaceful way. You had a very important, of course, Muslim community, but also Christians, and to also some extent Jews, that until the very end of the 19th century did not consider themselves as Zionist or had any pretension to go further with a certain nationalistic project. So there was a certain time when Jaffa was a kind of a multicultural city. In fact, until the Zionist movement started to exert a more important influence on the shaping of Israel.
Okay, so in the last part of your book, you suggest that the Tel Aviv-Jaffa problem lies at the heart of the Middle East conflict. Can you tell us what you mean by this, and what would need to happen to redress this problem?
First, I would say that we are speaking at a moment where Aleppo is taken by Syria. So, in fact, nowadays I don't know if nowadays I would it would be proper to say that this is the only problem in the Middle East, but at least as far as it concerns the Israeli-Palestinian situation, my claim is that as in fact the whole Jewish settlement in Palestine started in Tel Aviv and in Jaffa. In a sense, you might see how, in fact, the whole Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab conflict starts in a very small scale in a street fight in Jaffa. In that sense, you might see in a nutshell a much bigger conflict, but as it is exerted in quite a very small place, because Tel Aviv and Jaffa are quite small cities relatively to other important metropolitan concentrations in the world. I would say that if, as far as I am concerned, I would certainly would like to see a kind of a reparation, which its first steps should be symbolical and historical. So it means paying much more respect to Jaffa's Arabic past. For example, in the cover of the Hebrew edition, but I think it is also in the inner cover of the English one, there is this photo of the Gidi house, which is, in fact, the last remaining Palestinian structure of the neighborhood of Manshia. Since the late 70s, when it was reconstructed as some kind of a museum, it celebrates the conquest of Jaffa, and without any mention of Jaffa's really past. So I think that first it will be important to acknowledge Jaffa's history and also Jaffa's tragedy. I was thinking at the time, I still wish that if there would be some kind of reparation, it should start in the most important city in the state of Israel, which is Tel Aviv hyphen Jaffa. So this is a I think an important opportunity to acknowledge first this idea of occupation, because we are still occupying Jaffa and it has been made in very different means, such as the location of many army headquarters in Arabic buildings in Jaffa. There's a huge effort of gentrifying Jaffa. So there's a certain movement new Israeli very wealthy families who move in, and less wealthy Arabic families who move out to other cities in Israel. And of course there is this whole symbolical dimension of the city, which is completely biased, because one of the first steps done after the conquest of Jaffa in 48 was the annihilation of all the street names, the Arabic street names of the city. So even if you would be, let's say, a Palestinian refugee moving out from Jaffa in 48, if you look nowadays on a map of Jaffa, you could not really recognize your city, because all the street names have changed. In the first stage, they just numbered the streets. Later on, they started to name the streets after European composers and philosophers, or all kinds of East European rabbis. So, in fact, this idea of conquest is not only applied on the physical body of the city, but it includes also all the cultural, historical, and symbolical facets of the city. So I think that this is a huge project. How to relate to this city? How to relate to this past, which we might consider it as some kind of, I would say, a prototype for solving problems in other regions of the, in other places, in other areas of the states, and maybe in more regions. So, in this sense, I cannot really accept that the history of a city or history of architecture could be completely dissociated from the general history. And in that sense, the city, or I might even argue any city, is a very political, politically charged space. And this is something that we should really understand it in a much more profound way.
That's great. Thanks very much for that. So thanks very much for talking to us about your new book. It's really very interesting and I think a very important book. Before we let you go, would you be able to tell us very briefly about what you're working on next?
First, I would say that it is maybe important to say that this book on Tel Aviv and Jaffa is not so new for me. Originally, it was published in 2005 in Hebrew, and it is only now that it is published in English. During this period, I was involved in a few other projects, and I published two books, about, two other books about one about Israeli architecture and another one about my own neighborhood. Now I'm planning, I'm kind of working, I'm trying to complete three other books more or less at the same time. One about still about my neighborhood, but in a more I would say actual questions dealing with the question of immigrants, of refugees, which now populate my neighborhood. I am working also on a kind of a general critique of Israeli architecture, and I'm also working on a collection of essays which treat general questions of space and architecture too. So this is more or less what I'm doing, and apart this, as you said, I'm working, I'm teaching at the Bezalel Academy, so I'm very concerned and occupied with various questions of education.
Well, all those book projects sound really very interesting, so we hope to have you on the program again. That's all we have time for, so thank you very much for joining us. Thank you. So you've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies with your host, Max Kaiser. With us today, we had Sharon Rotbard, Senior Lecturer at Bezalel Academy in Jerusalem. He talked to us about his new book, White City, Black City, Architecture and War in Tel Aviv and Jaffa. It was published in English in 2015 by Pluto Press and MIT.